This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Anton Bruckner had started his career as a church organist at the age of 13, got most of his musical education at the Abbey of St. Florian in rural Austria, and never had any pretensions to being anything more than a simple man who had dedicated his life and work to the glory of his Creator. The center of musical Europe, though, was not rural Austria, but Vienna, where Bruckner was obviously, almost painfully, a fish out of water, an unsophisticated man from the countryside, totally lost in the political gamesmanship of Viennese musical life, and much too naive and insecure for his own good. Almost any comment from a critic, colleague, or student would send him back to his study for a rewrite, which is why so many of Bruckner's works exist in so many different versions, and why it has always been so difficult to figure out how exactly he intended his works to sound. Bruckner had been a successful teacher, a sensationally popular organist, and his Symphony No. 2 had made a powerful impact in 1873, despite the fact that the performance had been arranged over pretty much everyone's dead bodies. But he had also faced a history of rejection by the public, savage attacks in the press, and humiliations by orchestras, all of whom had recently rejected his 5th and 6th symphonies. Even after the success of the 7th Symphony in Leipzig and then Munich in 1884, he begged the Vienna Philharmonic not to play it, knowing what the critical reception would probably be. He was right, but the public disagreed, and Bruckner ended up taking multiple bows after each movement. With the curious exception of audiences in England and the U.S., the symphony enjoyed almost universal critical and popular acclaim, and was performed 16 times in the 3 years after its premiere. The movements of Bruckner's symphonies generally unfold in the classical sonata form of exposition, development, recapitulation, and coda. But rather than spinning out long, developed musical arguments, Bruckner tended to construct his musical cathedrals out of huge blocks of sound, like stone towers, finishing each one before starting on the next. In the 7th symphony, though, his blocks of sound turn into spacious, lofty archways of melody. The 7th begins with a firm foundation in its home key, E. But this E major is a soft hum, a background for an event rather than an event in its own right. Like the chords that open Beethoven's Eroica, Bruckner's hum is a declaration that E is the tonal center, and the task of the next hour's music is to affirm that center. The hum suddenly opens up into the first of those melodic archways, anchored by the cellos, with support from the violas, horns, and even a clarinet. It's the arch that supports the entire edifice, and it gives us a microcosm of the first movement, constantly pulling away from the opening E major towards B minor and B major, and then triumphantly reconquering its original tonality. There are three highly contrasting themes. The first, in the strings, opened the piece. The second block of sound is introduced by the winds, with a little more urgency. The third theme is in the brass, setting up the development section. This section begins with an air of hesitant mystery and ranges from densely active paragraphs of music to wonderful moments of quiet, almost static contemplation. The coda, as is typical in Bruckner's symphonies, begins in what seems to be a hodgepodge of themes. Set over a solid and unchanging E in the bass. For almost half of the coda, themes come and go, but suddenly the orchestra gets the point. And the final measures expand the bass note upward, tying everything together in the great E major affirmation we've been waiting for. Just as Beethoven had in his Ninth Symphony, Bruckner builds the slow movement of his Seventh on two contrasting ideas. The first, solemn, in minor mode and in a square meter. It's a reference to his own Te Deum, which was his final large-scale choral work and which he was working on at the same time. Bruckner introduces a new sound here, a quartet of Wagner tubas, an instrument designed for Wagner's Ring, to combine the mellowness of the French horn with the weight of the tuba. Here they serve as an introduction to the second melody, which is almost Mahlerian, more pastoral in major key and in triple meter, and used only twice. The rest of the movement is a set of variations on the first melody. Which builds in a series of upward steps, again a reference to the Te Deum. Bruckner uses the momentum of those upward steps to build a great climax in the first variation, and later, as stupendous a one as exists in any symphony. From that summit, the music descends into a grief-stricken and then profoundly peaceful memorial to Wagner. In January 1883, Bruckner wrote to a friend, "One day I came home and felt very sad. The thought had crossed my mind that before long the master would die, and then the theme of the adagio came to me. Wagner did in fact die just weeks later, and the quiet music that closes the movement with the return of the Wagner tubas became Bruckner's memorial to the man he worshipped above all living musicians. Then comes the scherzo. Again, like much of Beethoven, the movement is built more on a series of phrases than on complete melodies, a restless, repeated phrase in the strings, and a cheery cockcrow in the brass. As was customary for a symphonic scherzo, there is a slower, contrasting central section. Lightly scored and more pastoral. But leading to a fierce ending. The Bruckner scholar Robert Simpson wrote that the finale blends solemnity and humor in festive grandeur. It's full of ideas that run the gamut from the capricious to the sublimely simple to the magnificently grotesque. At the end, Bruckner gathers all his loose ends into a blaze of E major. With hints of the symphony's beginning, and the final opening of the heavens. Anton Bruckner's Seventh Symphony was one of the few of his compositions that was popular during his lifetime. His utter lack of self-confidence and refusal to write in the popular styles of either the Brahmsians or the Wagnerians had made life and work very difficult for him. But he also had, at the deepest level, an unshakable sense of what he needed to do and confidence in the ultimate rightness of his choices. The great conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler once said that Bruckner was less a musician than a descendant of the great German mystics, writing not for the present, but for eternity. Bruckner is one of those geniuses who have appeared but seldom in the course of European history, he said, whose destiny it was to render the transcendent real and to attract, even to compel, the element of the divine into our human world, end quote. Bruckner's cathedrals of sound continue to inspire us, as he knew, deep down, they eventually would. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.